Good evening. Thanks everyone, both in person and online, for joining for Messages from the Midrash, Parshat Vayigash. We're getting to the end of Parshat Bereishit, which is difficult to believe. We are reaching the climax of, of course, a very, very classic story, not one, but two sort of American media adaptations of the story, one a musical, one an animated film. And what we're getting to is the climax. And in some ways, last week, we left off at the commercial break, right? That cliffhanger commercial break where something really dramatic is about to happen, and then we cut. So Yosef accuses Binyamin of stealing his goblet, and the brothers, particularly Yehuda, pleads on his behalf. It's actually significant that that's Yehuda. Yehuda pleads on his behalf, and Yosef says, "I'm going to keep him here. The rest of you can go." And then cut. It's time for the commercial break. But something that's important to keep in mind as we open the parsha. So we're aware that Yaakov was very concerned with sending Binyamin down because Shimon was being held in captivity. Yosef, for all intents and purposes, is dead. He's not, but we think he is, and perhaps we'll come to that in a little while. A little bit more about that. And now it's Binyamin, Rachel's second son, and being that Yaakov has an affinity, a particular affinity for Rachel's children, sending Binyamin is something that's quite precarious. So Yaakov understandably does not want to send him down, but they're left with no choice. At a certain point, the famine's continuing, and Shimon is still there, by the way. I mean, you know, how does Yaakov think that Shimon's ever going to come back? We don't know, but they're left with no choice. So in order to convince Yaakov to send Binyamin down, so Reuven offers his two sons as a korban in that regard. He says, if something happens to Binyamin, you'll kill my two sons. Yaakov does not like this idea. But then comes Yehuda, says, Anochi ervenu miyadi tivakshenu. I myself will be a surety for him, a guarantor for him. You may hold me responsible. Actually should have highlighted this word. But Anochi ervenu imlochavirtiv alachavitzigativ. If I don't bring him back to you and send him before you, I shall stand guilty before you forever. So Yehuda is ready to set to be responsible, but the language here is significant. He uses the language of arev, of being a guarantor, which comes with certain halachic implications. So Midrash and Parshat Vayigash, and understanding What is it that makes Yehuda step up in this moment to take responsibilities? So the Midrash brings in this halakha question, Lamadenu Rabbeinu, Ezehu Arev Shehu Chayav L'Sham? Who is a guarantor who's actually responsible for a payment of a loan, right? So, of course, the classic Gemara names that would be used is Reuven lends to Shimon, and here I'm not talking about Reuven and Shimon, but I'm talking about fictional Reuven and Shimon. So Reuven lends money to Shimon, and Levi serves as the arev, that that if Shimon isn't going to repay it, so Levi will be the guarantor. So what makes somebody a guarantor that they're liable to repay? So Kachshan Rabotein, or our masters taught, Rabbi Shimon ben Anas, again totally different Shimon. Rabbi Shimon ben Anas Omer, Ezehu arev shehu chayav l'shalem, who is a guarantor who's responsible for payment of a loan? Omer havehu bani noten lecha v'nasa v'netan biyad ha'arav chayev. So if somebody says, lend him the money and I will repay you, and then they'll say Reuben's lending to Shimon, when Reuben gives the money to Shimon, to Levi to give to Shimon, that's when he becomes liable, which is a fascinating thing, because we often have, first of all, we have strict regulations in terms of what it means to make promises, to make vows. If you make a vow and you don't repay it, so you're very much sinning in that regard. We have a principle, on the other hand, a halachic principle, dvarim shebaleiv einam dvarim, that if you believe something, if you have an idea, let's say you don't verbalize a promise, but you kind of think that you're going to do something. So if you haven't verbalized it, it's nothing. And yet here we take it one step further and say that it's not, certainly not enough to think something and not even enough to say it. But the Arif has had to hold the money. He has to have held the money in his hand, right? The binding nature of our word is not enough. You need something real to substantiate here. That's I think that in itself is a very significant lesson, that get in as much as we're very cavalier with the way we throw around words and the way we say we'll do something, we're not going to do something. I say harbe. You have to give something that shows that you're serious. And words are cheap, but touching that money shows a little bit being more serious. But anyway, so the Midrash goes on to say, Zumi hayaze ha'arif, who was the guarantor in the story? Say Yehuda, this is Yehuda, she'amar tzna'oto al yadiv an yashiv ashivenu la. So it's like Yaakov is passing Binyamin through Yehuda, and Yehuda has become a guarantor. He has to return him. So then, go on a little bit tangent for a second. Why is Yaakov worried about sending Binyamin? So it's not even just about what might, this ruler who seems to be giving the brothers a difficult time. We're not even worried about there. First, we just want to make sure he gets to Egypt. Maybe there'll be an asun. Maybe there'll be some sort of disaster along the way. Robbers, weather, the like. That if somebody is traveling, the Satan is ready to bring charges, meaning he's ready to cause trouble when you're traveling. I think last year, actually, by Yigash, I talked about learning Torah on a journey and whether that's permissible, whether that's not. So there's discussions that maybe shouldn't get into an argument, shouldn't get into machlokas while you're traveling, even about Torah, because it might distract you. But there is perhaps something to be said for the fact that when Satan is away traveling, so things that don't involve machlokas, things that don't bring distraction, think Torah that's not, stunning Torah away that's not dangerous, perhaps is worthwhile. So, but there's a concern that disaster can strike along the way. So that's Yaakov's concern about Binyamin. Amar Rabbi Yosi, Rabbi Chanina, l'fisha shanin al-shalosh averot, nashime tov b'shat leilatam. So they say this at the end of Bama Malikin every Friday night, that there are three particular sins for which women might die for, Rahman al-Tzlan, at childbirth. So why specifically at childbirth? Because that's the time when Satan is ready to strike, that when there's already danger at hand, so there's that danger is perhaps multiplied by other factors. So that's Yaakov's fear of sending Binyamin, that there's perhaps a particular danger. But anyway, so Yara Binyamin and Machav Lakhushever. So they go down and they bring and they get their produce that they're going to bring back. Siva Yosef Nanu and Tal Gavia Besako. So Yosef tells them to put the goblet in the sack. What are you doing? Why are you stealing from me? So anybody who, the person who stole the goblet will be my servant. When it was found in Binyamin's sack, each one of them turned away. Who's the one who stood up? It's the guarantor. Yehuda, as the guarantor, is the one who stands up. Yehuda, and that explains Yehuda's approaching Yosef. So this is a powerful midrash, especially this end. So we know, of course, that Yehuda steps up, but the part that we don't necessarily think about, that's not necessarily as emphasized as part of the story in the Torah, it's not just that Yehuda stepped up, but it's that all the other brothers literally and figuratively turned their heads away. That the other brothers were ready to walk away. That's it. That's the end of it. So they're ready to leave Binyamin physically, but also, of course, there's that figurative sense of shirking responsibility. Except, of course, Yehuda steps up. So it seems clear on some level that had Yehuda not been an Arif, he probably also would have turned away. And why shouldn't they have turned away? Why shouldn't they back away? What would they accomplish by dealing with Yosef? Why would they expect Yosef is this powerful ruler? He clearly has the upper hand because he has the food. He's number two in the whole country. There's no way that these guys who Yosef is already suspicious of, there's no way that they're going to get anywhere with him. So on some level, why would we expect anybody to step up? But that's the significance of this halakha that we mentioned at the beginning, that that an arev is not just somebody who says something. It wasn't just a way to get Yaakov to send him down, but there was real action, real responsibility that was taking place. And Yehuda knew that if he came back without Binyamin, that he was going to be very serious trouble. So I think in thinking about this halacha and thinking about this this illumination of the story, so we have a famous statement in the Gemara, Ko Yisrael Arevim Zebaze. Sometimes it's people say Zalaze, and the Gemara is Zebaze. All of Israel, we say, is responsible for one another. But it's not just, again, it's not just responsible in an abstract way that I think about it and I say it, but the halacha concept of Arev is a very serious thing that a Beit Din can come back to you and say, you're culpable. So there's a halachic aspect in helping someone else fulfill a mitzvah. That's how we often apply this principle. So let's say, this can happen sometimes. Let's say I make Kiddush at Kiddush and somebody else hasn't heard Kiddush yet. And for whatever reason, they're not going to make Kiddush. So I can make Kiddush for them. More relevant in some way. On Shabbos morning, it's Borei Pirag Gafen, but on Friday night, so you have a whole extra bracha. So if you've already made Kiddush, you've been Yotzei your Kiddush. At the same time, you can make Kiddush for somebody else, even if you already did, because Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebaze, we're allowed to help each other out with a mitzvah. So there's that halachic aspect of it. But this concept is also brought in terms of saving people in two senses. Number one, there's the social responsibility aspect of it, right? That when Jews are being persecuted in the Soviet Union, that when that happened decades ago, so it was our responsibility to stand up. There's also the concept of saving people in the terms of sin. So I think just to bring this a little bit down to earth, there's two particular things I'm thinking about. Number one is that I think there's an aspect of tzedakah that is outrageous. So sometimes we just think of tzedakah, we translate it as charity, we think of it as just, I know somebody's poor, I'm going to give them my money, and that's the end of it. But there's a prohibition, when it comes to hilchot tzedakah, there's a prohibition of being malim ayin, meaning if I see a poor person approaching me, I'm not allowed to turn the other way, pretend I don't see them, and the like. That's a mitzvah lo taseh. I'm not allowed to do that. It says that explicitly in Parshat Re'eh. So there I see the parallels here to the situation with Binyamin, that the other brothers, in a certain sense, were malim ayin, that they turned a blind eye, they turned their heads away, as the Midrash says. And it's Yehuda who got the right message. And it wasn't convenient for him. It could have been a very risky prospect for him. But that's what it is. And it's the same thing with tzedakah in a certain sense. By the way, I think tzedakah is one of the hardest mitzvahs, especially as a rabbi. And again, it's one thing to, you go online and you donate to your favorite charity and you trust them alone. But when someone comes to you and says, I need your help, and you don't necessarily know, do I trust them? How much am I going to give? It's a very difficult thing. It's not always convenient. And yet there's this aspect of not being malim ayin, which is, in a certain sense, it's arivut. It's beyond just the nice aspect of charity, but we're actually bound. It's a mitzvah to give to other Jews. That's a real responsibility. Of course, there's a limit to what I can and should do. But I think tzedakah has that element of arivut. And there's also the aspect of saving others from sin, that sometimes we think that if somebody else is sinning, so that's between them and God, it's not necessarily my problem. If I say something, it's not going to do anything, it's not my business. But the mitzvah to give tochacha, the mitzvah to rebuke somebody, to say that you're violating this prohibition, that you're not acting in the proper manner. So that runs under the assumption of arevut, that we have a response, and that those are the cases that comes up with the Gemara, that we have a response, since we are responsible for one another. So it's not enough for me to be doing the right thing, and that's their problem. But we actually have that sort of responsibility, and if they're not doing right, then I'm not doing right. There was in the recent Jewish Action that was published by the Orthodox Union. So there was a discussion on the Pew Report. So they ran this discussion back in 2014 after the 2013 Pew Report, and here in 2021 they ran a very similar discussion, panel discussion, if you will, with a number of people who had actually contributed to that original one. So they got some updated thoughts based on the recent findings. So you can see what these leaders in our community wrote there. But one particular message I want to call attention to is that from Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg in Boca Raton, Florida, where he wrote that back then and still now, he says that we can't rely on outreach professionals and rabbis to do all the kiruv, because first of all, already, like, you know, there's a costume, and there's only so many people that, you know, the scale of assimilation and intermarriage that's going on can't just be accomplished by a few professionals, but it has to be everyone on the ground, everybody who knows somebody who might appreciate an invitation to a Shabbos dinner, might have a good experience, any opportunity to make a Kiddush Hashem. That's where all this happens, really happens on the ground, right? You have the leaders can create the atmosphere and can sort of guide the mission, but everybody has to be part of that sense of mission. He says that's what Chabad's success is, and that's where modern Orthodoxy and other places should be taking from the playbook, is that Chabad's success is that they inculcate this mission. It's not just for the official rabbis to be involved in Kiruv, but they send really anybody and everybody to go to Ben Yehuda to put Tulan on and go around with Lulav and Esrog and the like. So that's true arevut, that realizing that it's my problem as much as anyone else's. In a certain sense, it's interesting that the brothers that Yosef's brothers are all Bnei Yisrael. I should say Binyamin's brothers are all Bnei Yisrael. And apparently they did not have that sense of arevut. Maybe at that stage, you know, I could argue that there wasn't. I mean, they're brothers, so it's kind of hard to see, but... And again, you know, there are reasons here why this is definitely a precarious situation, and it would be understandable for one to kind of run away from it. But they did not have the sense of virus. But it's possible that Har Sinai, when we became a nation, so we became a Arevim Zebazah in that sense, and not just in a lofty way, and you know, a nice slogan that can be thrown around, but the act of being at Har Sinai, being part of the Brit, is not just a vertical relationship that we have with the Ribbono Shel Olam, but it was also sort of a horizontal relationship that we have with one another. And I think what we learned from this year is that we all have to be Yehuda here. It's not just that when it's convenient that I decide that I want to help somebody else, but there's a real responsibility that Yehuda accepted upon themselves. And as part of the Jewish people, we also, by definition, have that responsibility. And going on this theme a little bit, so there's another midrash later on that tells us a little bit about how Yehuda got there, because Yehuda's responsibility doesn't come from nowhere. If you recall, brothers wanted to kill Yosef. Reuven tries to prevent that. And they put him in the pit, and Yehuda says, you know, maybe we shouldn't kill him, but we should sell him. So the Midrash goes on in Siman Tet. It says on the sheet, open the Tanchuma Tzofel, tell me. So Yaakov sent Yehuda before Yosef. The envy of Ephraim shall depart. So Ephraim is the son of Yosef, that Ephraim is not going to envy Yehuda. So there's this, it's fascinating. There's really this, throughout Jewish history, there's this, I guess, up until the up until the Lost Tribes, there's this ongoing feud between Ephraim and Yehuda. Ephraim was the kingdom that split up. It's the people from Ephraim that split off from Yehuda in Melachim Bet after the days of Shlomo. But here the Navi is talking about a time where there will be no envy between Yehuda and Ephraim. So Midrash goes on to explain, Lefisha Yaakov Avinu Savor Yehuda Haraged Yosef V'Shashevi'u Lo Takatonet. So this is interesting. Again, like we know omnisciently, we know a little bit about Yehuda's role in the story, but as far as the Torah tells us, we just kind of assume that that Yaakov thought that Yosef was dead, and the brothers say that he was eaten up by a wild animal. So that's it. But the Midrash is telling us here that Yaakov had a suspicion. Yaakov had a lot of time to stoop and think about that. Right? He didn't think about anything else for a couple decades. And Yaakov came to the conclusion that it was Yehuda who killed Yosef. It was Yehuda who said, So Yaakov says, it's my son, quote, an evil beast has devoured him. And the word chaya, so we think it's a wild animal, but Midrash says it actually refers to Yehuda, because in Parsha Vayechi, Gur Aryeh Yehuda. Yehuda is compared to a lion. So Yehuda the lion was the one who killed Yosef. That's the implicit message here. V'haya omer Yaakov Yehuda, ata hu sheratar after oto, it's your fault, you killed him. L'pichach v'ikra Yaakov zimotav, and that's why Yaakov rent his clothing. So it's not just that Yosef died, but he's also mourning the fact that his own son killed another son. And they all tried to comfort him.
What about Reuben and Shimon? I mean, Shimon and Levi. Didn't Yaakov suspect that they were the ones who got rid of Yosef?
So that's a good question.
Especially in Vayechi. He says they saw an ox, and the ox is Yosef in the Zohar HaBracha.
So it could be. There's interpretation here, but Yehuda seems to be the focus here. So I'm going to skip here. So we get a little bit into Yaakov stooping in his mourning and the like. So it's right. So it goes on. So in Vayishev, it's Vayeko Tovip that Yaakov cried for Yosef. The Midianites sold Yosef into Egypt. So Amar Lakadosh Baruch Hu Yehuda, in the Chabani Manachshav, Yehuda, you didn't have any children up until now. Yehuda wasn't married. Then that we learn about his marriage in the next chapter. But you don't have sons. You don't know. You've never experienced a grief caused by sons. Because you can read that in multiple ways. But certainly he doesn't know what it's like to have that emotional attachment to a child and something happening to that. So atati ganta davicha b'eta b'taraf taraf Yosef. So you tormented your father. You deceived him by saying that Yosef was ripped up by an animal. By the way, I mean, Yaakov thinks that Yehuda killed Yosef, but in certain ways, Yehuda killed his father in a certain sense by bringing him that sort of grief. So the Mida, connected Mida here is that Yehuda is going to have kids and he's going to bury them. What's written afterward? So right after Yosef is sold, it says that Yehuda descended from his brothers. So what does it mean that he descended? What does it mean by Yered? It doesn't say that he just, it could have just said Vayelech elsewhere. So why does it say Vayered Yehuda Me'etachav? So he was excommunicated. He was, translation here, separated, but Nina does much stronger. He was banished. He was pushed out by his brothers. In a certain sense, again, it's interesting. Like, you know, Yehuda's the one who steps up. Vayigash Elav Yehuda, but in a certain sense, and the brothers don't do anything. So here too, also, the brothers kind of just seem that the brothers not really taking responsibility that, yeah, we were involved, but it wasn't really us. I mean, this is what happens in school all the time. Yeah, no, like, maybe I did something wrong, but no, it was everybody else who misbehaved. So when Yehuda said, let's sell him. If he would have said, let's return him, how you show him love? Brothers, because the brothers are saying, if you had said, let's bring him back, so we would have done it. We were dead set on killing him. We would have listened to you, but Yehuda made it worse. So Yehuda descended. He was deposed from being the leader. He descended from his greatness. Right? At that point, the brothers can't look up to Yehuda anymore. So then we go on to learn a little bit about what, in fact, happens to Yehuda, and he gets married. He has two kids, Aaron and Onan, and they die. So it's interesting that, according to Pshat, obviously, they died of their own sins. But there's a little bit here that's hashkacha in the sense that Hashem is punishing Yehuda for what he did to his brother and especially to his father. This whole time, Yaakov thinks that Yehuda killed him. So, where do you learn this from? Binyamin. We learn this from Binyamin. Shekach amar Yehuda liYosef ki avdecha harav etanan. So where do we learn this from? From the episode with Binyamin, because Yehuda says to Yosef, your servant is a guarantor for the boy, for Binyamin. So Kevin Shnatan Avshal Binyamin Benit Vada Yosef, Nimza Yehuda Naki Mikol Otan Advan. So at that point, when Yehuda is able to take up their responsibility and be the arev for Binyamin, so Yaakov eventually will become obviously aware that Yehuda was innocent, but Yosef also sees that Yehuda is on tshuva, and he exonerates him from all good. So, but Havi of Esar Kinat Ephraim, and that's when the envy of Ephraim, aka of Yosef, was mitigated. And that's why Yehuda, that's why Yaakov specifically sent Yehuda down and made Yehuda the guarantor. So in some ways it's Yehuda who offers it. In other ways, Yaakov comes to realize that in fact it wasn't really Yehuda, but Yehuda's abilities to step up doesn't just come from his ability to be a guarantor. His internalizing the message of Arivut doesn't come from nowhere. But it comes from this experience, which is obviously true in many walks of life, that the way we come to sometimes to rise to occasion sometimes comes from failure. That as the Pasuk in Kohelet tells us, that a tzaddik falls seven times. It's not just a person falls seven times, but someone specifically, as Rav Putner explained it, a person can only be a tzaddik if they've fallen seven times. And that's Yehuda here, that his greatness, and of course Yehuda becomes the ancestor of Amalek David and Mashiach, and he's going to, and it's his Shevet that's going to have the kingdom. They're the ones who survived. They're the ones who really write the story of Jewish history. So Yehuda's whole story is that he internalizes this very important message that to be a Jew, to be part of B'nai Israel, is to take responsibility, to be a guarantor. But perhaps it comes from this episode where he led other people astray and certainly did not take the right kind of responsibility, but eventually comes to rise to the occasion, and Yosef comes to forgive him, and apparently so does Yaakov as well. Thanks for joining, and learn more about the Parsha this coming Shabbos, but wishing everyone a wonderful week.